Okay, a quick show of hands. Who is new to any radio hobby? Any part of the radio hobby? Brand new?
3 years.
3 years? Okay. I'm glad the newbies are close up to the front because I don't want you to miss anything.
Wait a minute, do I have to go way to the back then?
Did you take a shower?
Yeah.
You're okay. Okay, specifically, tonight is something that came out of a conversation that I had with the Festmeisters last year about that. We really need a presentation, a talk, for those who are totally uninitiated to what the whole radio field is. Radio, TV, satellites, you name it. Also, I guess for those who've been in it for so long that they forgot why they started to begin with. Okay? Personally, I got started 45 years ago when I was 12 years old. Because my parents gave me a pocket AM radio. I wanted to figure out how the damn thing works. I went to the library and got the book like this to study and taught myself that summer. It was the Amateur Radio Handbook. Eventually, I did become a ham myself. My wife became a ham. I have some daughters who were almost hams. One quit 1 week shy of taking her test because she wanted to be out with the boyfriend on Friday nights. But it happens. So, tonight is going to take you through where did this all start before us? For example, look at what's on the screen. All these different things have one thing in common. From Kirk's communicator to Wi-Fi to the little key fob that you have on your car, they're all radio devices of some type. Yet we use them every day. We don't even think of them as radios. Your cell phone is a radio. Software defined radio, but it's a radio. As time goes on, we're constantly making things more complex because we're building from what we know before. It's like a tangent curve. Those of you who are science and math majors, you'll recognize the curve. Okay, so we're building on the shoulders of giants. So, very famous scientist, science fiction author, Arthur C. Clarke. Any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. Go to the jungles of Borneo and take out your cell phone. Take out a cigarette lighter. Magic, fire from the fingers. Well, we're gonna go through how do we get here, which actually did not start that long ago. Remember Ben Franklin, his experiment with the key on the kite and the lightning and gave himself a little shock on his knuckle? That was the late 1700s, mid to late 1700s, so not that long ago. Now, people thought it was like a game. They would shock each other. I'm sure you've done this. You've rubbed your feet on a rug and gone up and zapped the cat in the nose with the static charge, right? Yeah, me and cats, eh. But that's what people used to do for fun. They find ways of building up charges and zapping each other. Because they thought, you know, it's an interesting curiosity. But what do we do with it? Yeah, we can experiment. We can see what attracts and repels, but why does it work? Well, 1786. Revolutionary War is over. We're forming this country. We've got our constitution in place. And the world is now looking at science. So galvanic skin response, you know, all sorts of different things like that. Yeah, well, he did it with frog's legs. Killed the frog, grabbed its legs, touched copper here and a zinc there and watched them twitch. He didn't know why, but it was another one of his curiosities. In Italy, Alessandro Volta says, okay, two metals. So he takes one metal, two metal, and makes a stack of alternating metal. Okay, zinc and copper. Pours an acid in there, connects the wires to it and says, wow, I get a bigger charge this time. It was a battery. They called it a voltaic pile. It's a battery. And that's why they named it after him, volts. Now you can store charges, make a little capacitor charge, a Leyden jar, they called this. They would store the charge in there, wait for somebody to walk by and touch it. It's like those little goof boxes you make with the battery in it and the coil. And sign says, don't touch. Somebody touches and they get zapped. Same kind of thing. So Germans get involved in this too. Gauss starts doing experiments and trying to figure out electric charges. Comes up mathematical formulas. Orr said the same thing, but now he's noticing, hey, this is throwing off the compass. Ampere, which the amps are named after, current, is doing calculations on how much current's going through circuits and how it's having an effect. Now, Orsted goes and has an experiment. He says, things don't really work that way, and he wants to prove it. So he puts the compass there, puts the wire next to it, and he wants to prove it doesn't work. And he was, pardon the pun, shocked when the compass started moving on him. Joseph Henry in upstate New York starts working with this, wrapping wire around bars, and hey, he's got an electromagnet. Makes them bigger and bigger and bigger, and now they can lift 700 pounds of metal. Yeah, 1824. Sturgeon creates the electromagnet, saying, well, electricity creates magnetism, though we can't figure out why magnetism happens in the real world. But then on the flip side, Michael Faraday, who was a poor kid who got work as a bookbinder and then started working with the scientists, discovers, hey, you can do the opposite. You can have magnetism create electricity. So he starts working up formulas for that. And they named capacitance after him, a Faraday. Oh, and Henry, inductance, the coils. Only we use millihenries in ham radio. We don't use full henries because that's what lifts 750 pounds of metal. So Henry starts doing some work with Morse, because Morse needs a way of remotely causing a sounder to click. Put the electricity over here on and off, and cause an electromagnet over there to start pulling the sounder down. What do we have? Telegraph. A lot is happening in this time period. We haven't even gone, 50 years? And we've gone from playing around with frog's legs to making a telegraph. Just keep building, higher and higher. Morse also develops this little code, short and long sounds in different combinations to make letters. Morse code. Dee, 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 dee. So now we try to get the telegraph to work. We try to get it to work over longer distances. We do experimentations and grounding and wires and all this. And they actually make a cable that goes across the Atlantic between England and the United States in the mid-1800s. Eventually, we wind up using similar cables to have long-distance phone calls go through the same cable. But that's going to take a little while longer because we still have to invent the telephone. So some people start thinking, well, why can't we make this somehow jump the gap? Why do we have to run wires all over the place? Can't we do this wirelessly? How would that work? Well, James Clerk Maxwell came from better background than Faraday. Does very well in school, and he starts theorizing on things and experimenting. And he actually comes up with mathematical formulas that prove that electromagnetism encompasses everything that we're going to touch. Radio, light, and we actually find out it does gamma rays, X-rays. They're all related. He actually works out how they're interrelated. He works out the complex calculations using calculus. People think he's up here. But it sounds good, but does it work? Well, that takes a few other people. They had to apply his formulas to previous experimentation. Anybody build magnetic loop antennas? Okay, why do you have magnetic loop antennas? Because that's the other field compared to electricity. They're 90 degrees to each other. One's horizontal, one's vertical, okay? So now we get some other scientists jumping on board trying to figure out how all this can work better. So Mueller starts working on sensations and what you can sense and detect. Of course, he's got some weird ideas like feeling colors and hearing shapes and smelling sounds, and it doesn't work, but he figures out how the senses actually do work. Then his pupil, Helmholtz, jumps in and starts figuring out, okay, my teacher talked about sounds. What are sounds? The different frequencies. Can they happen at the same time? and he starts doing experimentation with that. He even used the electromagnet to cause a tuning fork to vibrate by putting electricity through it, on and off, and watching the thing start vibrating. And this guy, Scott DeMartinville, now is doing experimentations with sound, which actually became the forerunner of what Thomas Edison did with the phonograph. So he starts talking into this cone, and it's causing the membrane to be vibrated, and this little bristle starts scratching on the glass and makes these, let me give you some light.
So it's toggle switch. Hit the toggle switch.
Sorry, I got it. Make it dark enough. Yeah. And it starts scratching on the glass, just like that. So you can see where the voice peaks are. Now, take all these different things together, and what do you get? You collect sound in a microphone, electromagnet is caused to vibrate, create electricity, send it down the wire to another electromagnet that's pulling on the speaker coil and back. So what do we have? A telephone, 1876. Bell. On the shoulders of giants. Now, Heinrich Hertz, a young scientist in Germany, is looking at the stuff that Maxwell was saying and what Faraday was saying. He says, why can't we actually transmit this? So to prove the theories, he actually built a transmitter. An induction coil, and caused it to create a spark. And the spark actually gets received by receiver.
How far away?
Well, he started close together and started getting further and further away as he built up the power. Now, one thing he also found out was if the receiver antenna wasn't exactly the same length as the transmitter antenna, you didn't get as much spark. Resonance. That's why today we make sure that our antennas are made for the frequencies we want them for, because then it'll work the best. This is how he came up with that. Trying to get the spark to be the brightest, the loudest, the strongest. And now, frequencies are named after him, call them the Hertz. One cycle per second is a Hertz. So today, on your radio dials, you have kilohertz, thousands of hertz, megahertz, millions of hertz, gigahertz, billions of hertz, and boy, does it hurt.
Yeah.
Well, that one's not there. Though there was a theory back in the 80s that if you took your radio dial and went backwards below zero, you got megahertz. Well, that may have been an April Fool's joke, but... Okay, so the first radio receiver was nothing but a loop with a short gap, two big... I think they were brass that he had on them. Two balls of brass, because it increased the surface area that the static charge could build up on and jump across.
So you could say that he had brass balls.
Yeah.
I guess you can.
Yeah.
We won't say what happened when they, during stormy weather. We Irish in our limericks. Anyway, so we get frequencies out of that by how many cycles per second, how many hertz that we can generate. And we go up into microwaves easily today. Radio waves, he started discovering that they didn't exactly go in a straight line either. Sometimes they would bounce off of something. We had to wait till Marconi really worked on that to get an idea of how that worked. But he looked at this and figured out. He was also doing all sorts of other stuff, cathode ray tubes, the forerunner of television tubes before we went to flat screen. Okay? Well, they used to do it in glass jars and put chemicals in there and put high electricity in there, watch them glow. What they didn't understand was they were actually creating X-rays. And when they made it too strong, they bombarded themselves with X-rays, and Heinrich Hertz, unfortunately, died of a blood disease caused by the X-rays.
Wow.
So when your mother told you don't sit too close to the TV set, she meant it. So we can see radio waves going in all sorts of different directions. And over the years, we figured out, hey, they bounce off the sky, off the ionosphere. We can go further on certain frequencies. So, we've come down to this. How do we make it practical? Three guys at approximately the same time figured out how to make devices that actually transmitted on a frequency that they wanted, so they can have a wireless telegraph. So the first guy on your left is Marconi from Italy. Person in the middle is Nikola Tesla, who actually demonstrated the first working transmitter a few years before Marconi came out with it. But then it was a matter of patents, and Marconi got the patent. And the last guy is Alexander Popov, which according to Russian lore, was working for the Russian Navy and was doing experiments of his own after attending conferences in Europe.
Wasn't Fessenden somewhere in that lineup?
Fessenden's coming up. Okay. We're getting to Fessenden.
Okay.
Okay, Marconi, born in 1874, had an Italian father, wealthy, noble birth. His mother, well, not too bad. She was the heiress to the Jameson whiskey fortune. Yeah. So, yeah, royalty, Irish royalty. So he's interested in technical things. So he goes to the Technical Institute, learns about telegraphy, reads about Heinrich Hertz's death and everything that he did, and inspires him to do more experimentation along those lines. So he tweaks with the circuit, figures out a few different things, and actually gets it to work better. It's still a spark. It's still making hashy noises, not the pure Morse code you hear today on the radio waves. But he did some experiments. He and his friends, and they worked together. See that big panel above his head? That's actually the antenna. It's a, yeah, right? Just a big sheet of metal. And he's aiming it and turning it and everything else and doing his experiments that way. Keeps improving his radio circuits, gets patents for it. This one he filed in 1900. Then you got Tesla. Serbian. Studies. Learns about things. Wants to go to America. Goes to America. And tries to get a job with Edison. Well, yeah, well, we know what happened with Edison. Edison was also a little stuck up. But Tesla had these grand ideas that weren't believed by many people. The reason why you have alternating current in your wall socket is because of Tesla,
exactly.
Not Edison.
Nope.
Edison was using direct current, DC, so like your car battery. But the electricity would die after so many miles before it reached your house because of internal resistance in the wires. Tesla says, nah, we can do this better. We know about transformers, we know about coils, we know how they work with each other, so why don't we just send it down this way and then step it up in voltage, step it down in voltage, and by the time it gets to the person's house, it's what we want. You don't have a loss. So he started working with Westinghouse, made a few things. Tesla coil is actually a huge alternator. Sort of like the alternator in your car generates electricity to charge your battery and your car radio and lights and everything else. Well, he makes a Tesla coil. It makes it so strong that electricity is actually traveling through the air. That's why he can sit under that. Because he built himself a Faraday cage to keep the electricity away from him. But it's proving that it's powerful and that electricity can move. And of course, we've got Popov. Not a lot's written about him. There's an article on Wikipedia that goes into some of what's attributed to him and what he did with the Russian Navy and did some experiments on a college campus trying to get a signal from one building to the next. But then sometimes you can't quite get all the information or believe what you hear from the old Russian archives. We've known plenty of stories, including what Chekhov said, who invented what on Star Trek. It was always a Russian. So here we are, we've gone from wired communication to now we're just starting to get wireless communication. We can do Morse code, we can do telegraphs over the air using spark gaps. But what do we really want to do with it? Well, Fessenden wanted to transmit sound. We already have a telephone at this point. People are talking to each other. If they can afford the telephone, they can talk to each other. But what about talking to each other wirelessly? So he's doing some experiments and actually did a broadcast. Low-powered one, didn't work very far, but actually transmitted voice. But he needed more power to get it done properly. So who does he turn to? Alexanderson. Okay, there is this huge alternator. Was it 17 kilohertz over in Sweden? 17, 20 kilohertz? They still fire the thing up every so often. Just, you know, it's like, okay, we're going to celebrate whatever, and they fire it up and send out some Morse code. But he generates these alternators that have so much power to them that now you can actually produce enough energy to transmit that voice further. So he says, okay, I know what I'm going to do with this. Christmas Eve, 1906. Ships at sea are using the wireless telegraph to send messages to each other. And all of a sudden, they start hearing voices on the frequency. They hear poetry reading, Bible verses, somebody singing, violin playing. It's like, whoa, what is this? Fessenden proved it can be done. Now it's just a matter of tweaking things, making the receivers more sensitive, the transmitters more powerful. All of us have built passive little devices when we were kids, those of us in the radio hobby. Crystal radios, little things that built into plastic pens and oatmeal boxes with wires on them and cat whisker. Okay, some of us are older than others. But we've done things like this because that's the simple way of doing it. But it has limitations. So when we have a limitation, we look for ways of improving it. John Fleming creates technically what's the first tube to try and amplify the sound. Of course, he did some experiments with the tube and hooked it up to a frog's leg and was picking up transmissions from the Eiffel Tower. Okay, I don't know what's with frog legs, but I don't eat them. Yeah, some people like them. Okay, Lee DeForest says, okay, we need to make this tube better. So what does he do? He sticks this little wire in front of it, a little bent wire. You can see it on the left. And that amplifies it, makes it louder. But he has no idea why it works. But he files for patent anyway. And there's some patent fights going back and forth, but he's sort of recognized as the creator of what's known as the Audion tube, the audio amplifier, which, as it turns out, if you make it stronger, you can actually use it as a transmitting oscillator. But that took somebody else to figure out how it worked, why it worked, and how to make it better, and that was Edwin Armstrong. Armstrong, from New York City, was born in Chelsea, parents moved to the Upper West Side, went to Columbia University. Brilliant guy. Loved experimenting with things, loved climbing things. His parents always said he climbed trees, climbed towers, doesn't matter what he did, he was always climbing. But the guy was brilliant. So, he looked at this Audion tube and figured out not only how it worked, but how am I going to improve it, and how I can actually make it so much better, it's going to boost the energy so much. And he called it regeneration. You generate a signal and you're going to loop it back into itself. Like that. That coil off the top of the tube is actually sticking some of the energy back into the input and feeding back into the tube again. So it's making this loop and making it stronger and stronger and stronger. And now we have a tube we can really use, not just for telegraph, but for voice and music. And this is while World War I is ready to start raging. Now, equipment was really simple. I mean, wooden boxes. Who's got wooden boxes these days? We got little plastic things like this. But back then, that's what they put all the circuits in. Wood. Wood was insulating. You couldn't get a shock from it. Then he made the super heterodyne. Just one stage after another, and let's clean this up and make it smoother. So, we've gotten to the point of a little more than 100 years ago. Okay, so all this that we've talked up to this point is about 125 years worth of experimentation, starting with frogs' legs and voltaic piles, And now we've got something we actually transmit music to. People all over the place. We can speak to each other. We can communicate finally long distances instead of putting a stamp on an envelope and waiting for it to arrive by the post office. I can say that from the inside. Okay, so now we get to how do we make money with this? Up to that point, Marconi was selling radios to ships so that the office can talk to the ship. Lots of ships. David Sarnoff, whose name will pop up later, was a kid. I know, he's an interesting character. I give you that. But he liked radio so much that he was thinking of what could we do with this? Of course, he also thought about what he can do for himself, but it was the thinkers. Remember what Dan Srebnick said this afternoon about imagination? You have hardware, software, and imagination. Well, here's somebody who had imagination. He may not have been the best people person, but he had imagination. You have to give him that. So as a kid, he gets a job with the Telegraph, Marconi Wireless, and happens to be working around the time that the Titanic goes down. Now, there are stories pro and con whether he actually did stay up all night for two nights straight handling telegraphs or not, but he was involved somehow. The Titanic. Supposed to be the unsinkable ship. First voyage out of dry dock. Belfast, Ireland, comes across, and they've got wireless on board. They got the best equipment. Yet at that time, ships only used radio for sending telegrams at cost. They were not for safety. They were not for entertainment, just to make money sending telegraphs. So at 9 o'clock at night, the radio man, it was at 9 or 10 o'clock at night, he shuts off the radio, it's time to go to bed. And then they hit the iceberg. Now luckily, the short message he was able to get off after turning the radio back on, other ships heard the request. Now there were some that were closer that didn't hear it, that should have heard it. So now you got this hodgepodge of finger pointing and whatnot when this is all over. But we lost a lot of people, because we weren't thinking about safety. How can we use the radio for that? No, they were using it for money. I mean, money, yeah, money's important, but as we found out, it's not the only thing. So it was all over the headlines. Now, wireless, because of all the chatter about it, became a hobby for people like you and me as little kids. Experimenters want to know how do things work. So we built things in crystal radios on oatmeal boxes. Round the wire on, they found the Galena crystal, little piece of wire, try to find the sensitive spot and listen to the weak sounds of some radio. Magazines came out, books came out, everybody was getting into the act. I'll bet you some of the stuff is still being sold at Hamfest.
Yeah.
I've seen some of it. But radio as a hobby was being geared mostly to the boys who were going to high school. As a technical trade. This is a new technology. I want you to learn it. Even the Boy Scouts got involved with it. Radio merit badges, okay? You see the dots and the dashes around the red lightning bolts?
BSA,
Boy Scouts of America. That was right on the cover of their book. Look at this, $17.50 for a 240 spark note, 60 cycle alternator. Yeah. Back then, that was huge. There were books written, book stories. You know, anybody remember Hardy Boys, Nancy Drew, Tom Swift? Okay. Well, there were actually stories that involved radio in those series of books. Okay, Tom Swift. They're trying to get the imagination going. Here's this new technology. Make it part of your life. Now, how things developed here and how things developed overseas, totally different. United Kingdom says, we're gonna control this. We're gonna fund whatever we're gonna do here. This is our ball of wax, because, hey, we're in charge. We're the king. So they created the BBC. That'll come back to haunt them later. But here in the United States, we started with, okay, everybody's interested in this, what do we do about it? So the Radio Act of 1912, after the sinking of the Titanic, they said, okay, we We need everybody to be on the same page. We're going to have licenses. Everybody's going to get licensed, even the experimenters. So that was the beginning of the amateur radio licenses. Everybody had a license. Now, some of those hobbyist experimenters were following Fessenden and actually broadcasting music. It was rough. You had to be able to afford the tubes and whatnot, which was kind of expensive. But some were starting to do that. By 1927, after broadcasting became huge and spreading all over the country, they had to rewrite the rules a bit and clean things up. And then, of course, that eventually became the FCC when they rewrote the rules again in 1934. Now, in 1912, when they gave the amateur radio license out to the experimenters, they said, oh, by the way, we want you off these frequencies the ships are using, and we want you to go up there. They figured, oh, those are useless frequencies. They'll get lost. No, it actually turned out to be better, because we found ways of bouncing the signal off the ionosphere and going much further than they were. Uh-huh. Okay, in 1915, there were many companies selling equipment, receivers, transmitters. These are the big ones at the time. AT&T, you know, telephone lines, which was different than the Bell Company. Eventually, they merged. So all this was happening in 1915. World War I had not happened yet for us. It was going on in Europe, but we weren't involved. But the government saw that if we can control communications, then we can actually do something with this. We can use it ourselves, as far as the government's concerned. So they forced all these different companies to cross-license, give each other the use of the patent for whatever the technology is. So now they all have common equipment that all works together. Doesn't matter which manufacturer's making it, they all work together. And then when we went into the war, we had all this equipment that were on all the ships. They were even in the planes. Yeah, we had biplanes with radios in them, starting in, I think, 1910. That's why you had two people on the plane. One flying it and one doing the Morse code. Well, shooting the gun, too. Okay, so a lot of these companies that were involved in this original enterprise were merged together, and that's what created RCA. And of course, Sarnoff, being the star of the Titanic telegraph, well, between that and his ideas of what radio could become, he actually became the general manager. So.
Can you back up just for a second?
Sure. I know, it's a lot.
So they tried to sabotage my company.
Of course. You kidding? The U.S. wants it for themselves. It's okay, fine. You know, we're going to do a little deal here. You can't have what we have. Oh, you're going down? Hey, we'll buy you out. Here's some money. Thank you. Bye. Now we'll get your stuff. Is that any different today?
No.
Nope. Okay, so the four companies that merged to create RCA, American, part of the Marconi Corporation, General Electric, which Thomas Edison was part of, American Telephone and Telegraph, and Westinghouse, which Tesla was part of. And these are some of the other players. Western Electric, Western Union Telegraph Lines, Edison, Marconi Corporation, all this merging together. Yes, United Fruit Company. We were... Yeah, huge, right. Getting all our fruit down, you know, bananas in Central America and all that. They needed ways of banana republics, right. We needed a way of communicating with the ships, bringing the stuff back, so they made heavy use of radio. So they got involved in this too. 8XK was the first station that actually broadcast something more than just a personal communication. But the forerunner of the FRC, the federal government didn't issue the first radio broadcasting license and worked out all the call sign structure until 1920. October 1920, KDKA in Pittsburgh got the first license. November was the presidential election, and they announced the presidential results to that election.
Wasn't WGY also part of that?
Soon. Yeah, well, They were the first, and then others were coming right behind them. WEAF in New York City was the first one to actually have an advertisement, a commercial message, not just music and culture and news. They actually had a commercial for a company.
Do you know what frequency they were on?
I'd have to look it up. Okay, now here's a list of different states and when they first got a broadcasting license. Some states didn't even get their first one until like 1930, Wyoming, Vermont. So it took a while for it to spread across the country. Even New York City, New York State didn't even get theirs until 1922.
It really caught on in the 20s, though.
Right. It just took off like crazy, because now they were able to easily mass produce equipment that worked, that was solid, and they needed programming for people to get attracted to it so they could sell them things, and just kept going and going and going. They call it the Roaring Twenties more than just flappers and booze. It was a lot of stuff like this.
It's a lot of production of receivers also.
Yes.
Receivers.
Exactly. So you had all sorts of broadcasting ideas going on. Even the universities were getting on board. That's why even today, a lot of universities have their research arms working on future stuff that eventually becomes commercial items. Yeah.
Didn't some of the department stores have radio stations,
mm-hmm.
like Gimbel's?
Or, right.
Oh, yeah.
And
newspapers.
Newspapers. Newspapers. Department stores.
Yeah.
There were two symphonies, the New York Philharmonic, and somebody else merged activities with United Fruit, and then actually under William Paley created CBS.
Yeah, because on Market Street in Philadelphia,
mm-hmm.
there were two fighting each other. Two radio stations from the two.
Well, that's why 1927, when they rewrote the rules in 1927, because frequencies were overlapping each other.
Yeah.
One was supposed to go off the air and it didn't, and another one came on.
They were fighting.
And they were fighting. So they had to revamp everything in the AM broadcast band.
Silent movie theaters, when some silent movie theaters had radio, I don't know what the tie-in was, but there's 195, just a few miles north of Philly, there's an old silent movie theater building with a big radio tower there. They had a radio station with
a sound movie. They would also have concerts in the theaters and
yeah.
broadcast it to people back home.
Yes.
Well, WQXR is a perfect example. The New York station, the radio station of the New York Times.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
How many watts is the world's largest
store? WLS, yeah. World's largest store. Okay. Radio plays, all sorts of things started coming out of this. Anything that people used to go to the theater to see and hear, they can actually do it from home now. On little boxes like this. They would use it in schools. Culture for kids, all sitting around one radio.
Wow.
I mean, when I was in the first and second grade in a Catholic school in Astoria, Queens, they rolled in a TV set with the microwave TV transmissions for the Archdiocese. Back then, it was just a radio. Use your mind for the pictures, kids, and get them together in a big assembly hall and get a lot of them listening to one thing at the same time. But yes, they were mass producing them. They were just building and building and building. This is 1925. This is a huge factory, and this was being done by hand. No machines were building radios. This is by hand with soldering irons and discrete components and tubes and wooden boxes. Lots and lots of people working on this.
Majority of women?
A lot of lady workers.
Yeah, because they had small fingers. They were able to get the components closer together than men with their fat, calloused fingers that they were actually using for construction. Besides, at the same time period, there's a lot of construction going on, especially in the big cities. So you needed the men to build the skyscrapers, and the women were making little things like this to make pieces of furniture that sat in your living room, you gathered around. And there's a better shot of one. And it was just the AM broadcast band. That's all it was, one band. Wasn't even that clean. Every time you had a lightning strike, static, okay? This is when we started seeing networks developing, stations linking together to share programming. AT&T goes off and they're doing their thing, and they're using the phone lines to transmit the program from station to station. RCA uses Western Union's telegraph lines, which weren't as good as the phone lines, but they still got their programming across. So one sounded a little better than the other, but AT&T was like buying out all sorts of contracts and whatnot. They were muscling through the whole thing. You know, talk about Ma Bell, even back then. So the government steps in and says, oh, no, 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 you're gonna sell off your radio stations. You're not gonna do this anymore. RCA then takes what's left over in the aftermath and creates the Red and Blue Network. The Red Network is on the phone lines, the Blue Network is on the Western Union lines, and the Blue Network actually becomes ABC after 1941.
What became ABC?
The Blue Network. The NBC Blue Network.
Is that why in the 70s NBC created a new logo, and it was this stylized N? One half of it was blue, and the other half of it was red.
Well, Bicentennial was coming.
Is that why?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, so we had CBS, ABC, NBC, the three big networks until probably about the 80s, 80s, 90s. Yeah. So, history from the 30s to the 80s, this started ramping up pretty quick because now you had programming, lots of different kinds of programming. People wanted to be able to experience things together of the same type, whether it be comedy, concerts, it was the Depression, FDR, wanted to calm everybody down, had his fireside chats. But we had everything that basically we have on TV today, but with a better rating system. So, any of you listen to old time radio programs on tapes? And yeah, and everything come crashing out. Okay, Burns and Allen, before they went to TV. Fred Allen, Abbott and Costello.
Yes.
Big names on radio back then.
Who's
on first? What's on second? I don't know. Third base? So radio was really hitting its stride. And then we had news. The Hindenburg disaster.
Oh, the humanity always crashing.
Okay, in New Jersey. Orson Welles.
War of the Worlds.
Yeah, exactly. The War of the Worlds. People were scared out of their boots.
Fake news.
Fake news. I got to be careful. This is going to be broadcast.
Radio scares the fake nation.
Oh, no.
Radio fake scares the nation. No. So why did something like that actually happen? Because at this point in people's psychology, radio was it. They believed whatever was coming through the radio. Yeah. They believe what comes through Facebook and Twitter, too. But they had faith in what was going on. World War II was about to get started big time. The Nazis were marching all over the place. They already grabbed the Sudetenland, and they went to Czechoslovakia and Austria. So things were crazy. And it was such a great show. The technical achievements, the writing achievements, people actually believed that this was real. Especially if they tuned in late, it's like, ah, the Martians are coming.
They landed in New Jersey.
Yeah. 50 years later, we'd be saying the Russians are coming. But then World War II hits and news is really hitting its stride. That's where Edward Murrow got his stripes. He traveled all over Europe, all over the war zone, and popped up in different parts of the world reporting the news by radio. Radio was it. TV was just an experimentation at that point. They tried to get it off the ground, but the war hit, so things had to be pulled back. But radio was it. So in the golden age of radio, RCA owns the NBC Red and Blue networks, eventually have to give up one of them. CBS, Mutual Broadcasting, which is all sorts of other independent stations that work together. Here's an interesting little thing. In 1934, Hugo Gernsback, very famous science mind publisher, science fiction, all sorts of things, wrote in an article in Radiocraft magazine that he sees the day when you can actually send a newspaper by radio.
They had wired fax,
but he wanted to do it wirelessly. He said you can reach more people by a radio broadcast.
Perfect.
So they start doing some testing and experimentation. RCA does tests. There's another guy, I think his name is Fisher or something, he did test too. They even demonstrated at the World's Fair. But World War II hits. Oh well, that goes away. And fax basically stays with businesses by wired lines. So RCA sells off the Blue Network to Lifesaver Candy Company and becomes ABC Networks. Now, with the war, we've had so many different things coming out of wartime. The governments were using shortwave radio for propaganda, for news. Voice of America. Anybody here from Voice of America tonight? I know I saw Kim earlier. Voice of America celebrates their 75th anniversary.
This morning.
75 years on the air, and their first broadcast. If you go to their website, look for the 75th anniversary page, and listen to the first recording. They tell the world, we will tell you the truth. It may not be good, it may be bad, it may be great, but we will tell you the truth. It's something to hold all of them up to. I don't care who they are. That's how we get rid of fake news. The truth. No opinions, truth. So what they also developed during the war, they took the vacuum tubes, shrunk them down. Lower power, less heat, smaller devices. Now you had walkie-talkies. Now granted, they were big like this, or they were like a knapsack, but they were smaller than that piece of furniture in your living room. Radar. The Brits loved the radar. They could see the planes of the Luftwaffe coming across the North Sea, and they see the little blips. At the same time, Arthur C. Clarke was with the crew, with the Royal Air Force, developing glide slope, which helped the RAF bombers coming back to land in the fog. Glide slope, radio frequencies that can tell you if you're too far to the left, too far to the right, too high, too low, so you land perfectly on the runway. We still use it today. It's called ILS.
Was radar a secret that the Germans didn't know?
Pretty much. And when they found out, then they started throwing out bits of aluminum to try and cause the chaff.
Yeah.
Right.
And they drove right past the radar antennas.
Mm-hmm.
They flew right past the radar antennas because they didn't know what they were.
They didn't know what it was. They just thought it was something weird.
Yeah.
And there was, we're pinging the signals right off of them. They have no idea that we're doing it. Okay? Radio direction finding techniques. You've seen it in all the war movies. The Nazis are driving around. They got this big loop on the top of the truck, and they're trying to find the spy with the little radio. Okay. Well, after the war, the BBC used the same technology to find everybody who was not paying a radio fee.
There you go.
Oh, you're listening to a radio. We don't see you paying your £5. Knock, knock, knock. So, like I said, the BBC comes full circle. Okay. Spy numbers, the Enigma. The amount of brain power that went through World War II to develop and crack a lot of these things was amazing. Without the computers that we have today. These are people who really knew their stuff. Coax cable. Something as simple as coax cable. Just like this. Okay? We were using twin lead. Parallel lines to feed antennas and whatnot. They found out when we went to the South Pacific, and it's raining all the time in the jungles, the twin lead was crap because it was changing the impedance. They couldn't use it with their antennas properly. Yeah, but coax, your signal's on the inside and the shield is on the outside. You can run this through water, it doesn't matter. Great invention. Now we all use coax. Spools and spools of it at Radio Shack. I don't know, is Radio Shack still selling coax?
Radio Shack still around?
Yeah. I saw one at 23rd Street and 6th Avenue. I walked in there. I'm teaching a tech general class in New York City. I walk in there and say, I need electronic parts. Real ones. Oh, all the way back there in the drawers. Yeah, right? They tried. Anybody who was a ham radio operator back then, if they weren't in the military doing radio work or teaching electronics or whatnot, they were made part of what's known as the War Emergency Radio Service, which is on VHF, and they helped the local civil defense, the air raid wardens. Because those signals don't go very far. The military want to keep them off the air so you're not talking to the enemy, but VHF signals stayed local. So those who were still home actually still got to play radio to some degree. Now, after the war, everything we learned from there keeps mushrooming. Shortwave radio is now used for propaganda in the Cold War. How many of us grew up in the Cold War? Little kids listening to, okay, air raid, drills, hide under your desk, yeah.
Duck and cover.
Okay. Janice was showing Radio Tirana earlier on the screen. I remember coming home from work in 1978, listening to all the different stations across the shortwave band, just so I can get an idea of what the news is all about. I listened to all viewpoints, and then whatever's common has to be the truth. Radio Tirana had more vile, dripping propaganda than Radio Moscow did. Chicken Noodle Network. So in 1949, they invented the transistor at the Bell Labs. So now we can start doing away with tubes, because transistors don't need as much electricity. They're smaller. They don't get hot. You can do a lot of things with them. So things are improving even faster. Single sideband that we take for granted. Those of us in amateur radio take single sideband for granted. They didn't have it in 1951. It was regular AM like you heard on your broadcast radio. Yeah, it's never going to catch on. They sound weird. You sound like Donald Duck, blah, 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 blah. Some hams working with General Curtis LeMay, who happened to be a ham himself. He's in charge of Strategic Air Command. They do an experiment. They put a single sideband radio on a plane and one back at SAC headquarters. And they're able to talk to that plane much further than they ever had before because it takes up less space. And that signal goes further with the same amount of power. Ah. Now the hams start jumping on board, and it was a fight for a while, but eventually it won out. TV, FM broadcasting, CB, GMRS, police and fire departments start using radios on VHF. They go to UHF in the 1980s. Okay, military starts bouncing signals off the moon, Fort Monmouth, Project Diana. Okay, I knew Nick Romanofsky, who was one of the scientists on that experiment. He was my landlord's son. Back in 1982. He told me all about the project. It was fascinating hearing it from the guy who actually did it. So all these experiments in the 50s, Arthur C. Clarke, the guy who was working on glide slope, okay, he actually came out with an idea in a newspaper article, I think it was 1945, that if we had satellites at a certain height, we could put three of them around the world and relay signals around the world. Now what do we have? HBO, Showtime, USA Network. We have everything up on the satellite now.
Goes.
Everything is up there. And he's the one that came up with the idea of putting them up there to begin with. Videotapes. I know we're into DVDs now. Well, Ampex with their videotapes came out in the 50s so they could record the TV shows that we seem to have copies of now and we could watch on Channel 3. Videotapes. So this golden age, AM still thrives, FM is coming into its beginning stages. Transistors are making radio smaller and smaller. The FCC finalizes how they want FM to work. They shifted around a frequency. That's why Armstrong Station, that was on 42 megs, that whole network, the Yankee network they were talking about earlier, okay, that went away. And they built this whole new FM band, further up the band. Public broadcasting. Now you got community stations, college stations. They want to get on the air. They want to talk to their audience. So the government's helping out. Corporation for Public Broadcasting, National Public Radio. TV. I Love Lucy, Honeymooners. All the old TV shows and people thinking, okay, that's going to kill radio. Well, yeah, even though TV took over a lot of the same kind of programming that radio did, there was one problem. You can't take your TV with you. Not until The Watchmen came out in 1982, but radio, you can take anywhere. You saw Janice today. She had FM radio in her cell phone. That should be coming back soon, even though most cell phone carriers don't let you do it. It should be coming back soon. So what kind of programming did we start getting the radio then? If TV took all these normal programs that we were used to, well, now you get blocks, formatted programming. Top 40, Murray the K. Wolfman Jack with his barn burner signal out of Mexico, blasting right up into the United States before NBC got him. All these things started developing. People had different tastes in music and programming. Talk shows, yeah, we got them now. Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, what's that woman's name, Miller, on the left. So a lot of different things. Rachel Maddow, right. So today, we can take any radio, even if you know nothing, take an AM radio and start tuning across the dial. Grab some of these stations up here. These are clear channels. Strong stations, 50,000 watts. Especially at night, they'll dominate that part of the spectrum. I know it's a little tough with IBOC and some of the tiny stations that pop up here and there, but you're still going to hear a lot of these. I love traveling, and when I travel on my way back home, especially at night, I'm tuning in all these different stations. I want to hear what's going on back home. I want to hear what's going on in Boston. I want to hear what's going on in Cincinnati. And I can pick up these clear channel stations and actually hear what's happening. Even if my cell phone is not in cell phone range like it is in West Virginia when I took a trip out to Kentucky back in September, also my cell phone's like, no coverage. Radio to the rescue. The radio culture today is broken down by different types of people, different types of programming, so you find what works for you. The FCC, of course, changes its rules. It used to be you're only allowed 7 AM stations, 7 FM stations, and 7 TV stations. Well, that got scrapped. They said, okay, you can have 20, 20, and 12. That got scrapped again. Now you can do whatever you want up to 35% of the audience. Well, that got scrapped again. Now it's 45% of the audience. How do you think we've got Clear Channel, Cumulus, all these big behemoths owning all these stations? Go through the FCC list and you'll see how many stations, just say in New York City, are all owned by one owner. It's amazing. See, Clear Channel, 1,190 stations as of a few years ago. They are big. The problem is, people like you and me still want to hear what we want to hear. So it may not be on any of their stations. So we go hunting for it. We can go hunting for it on the AM band, the FM band, shortwave. We can look many, many different sources. Unfortunately, we're also looking podcasts, smartphone apps. We're trying to pull things off the internet. However, what happens when the internet dies or your connection to the internet dies? You're out of luck. You got to go back to radio. And that's what interests us who have a love of this, is that we're always seeking things out. We're looking for that elusive station. We're looking for that weak signal. The ionosphere changes how the signal gets to us. We're trying to improve our station. Things are scattered all over the place frequency-wise. So this is just some quick little things I threw up there. Where submarines communicate, way, way down. The atomic clock that runs your automatic watches. You have an automatic watch or clock at home? Okay, well, it gets a signal of 60 kilohertz. It's way down in frequency, and that's coming out of Colorado. And makes it all the way here to the East Coast. Aircraft beacon, so they know how to steer to get to the next airport properly. If they can't see, they don't have radar, they don't have ADS-B, get a long wave receiver, and hey, I could point, and I know what frequency is near JFK. I'll point at that one, and it'll guide me right in. AM broadcast band, ham radio, shortwave broadcasting spectrum, VHF, UHF, television, which is now digital. And as we heard from Scott Feibusch today, that's going to change again when they start scrunching the band. It's kind of interesting stuff. You thought it was all over. It's still changing. Your Wi-Fi, your cell phones. The little key fob you have is at 315 megahertz. Just above the old garage door opener is at 311 megahertz. which they had to move because the Air Force was having problems on their frequency with them. Plane would come by and all of a sudden your garage door would open. So they changed the frequency. GPS, weather satellites, digital television. So now we get to what do we see now coming at us in the future? That is still radio. Okay? Get away from the internet. Yes, it's a great little toy, but let's just get to what can we still pick up ourselves? Dan talked about software-defined radio. There's going to be some other talks this weekend about software-defined radio. What is it? How does it work? How are you actually still using it today and you don't even know it? Digital broadcast. Digital Radio Mundial, DRM, has nothing to do with music licensing. It's a digital format that can take a shortwave channel and send you stereo music quite clearly and pictures. All that static crashes and now I get a clean signal? Hey, this is cool. And I don't need the internet for it. FL Digi software, written by W1HKJ, Dave Fries. I've been working with this since the beginning of 2011 and created two NBEMS nets on 40 meters back in July of 2011. We're having a blast with this, finding new and different ways to actually send data, pictures, binary files. Did an experiment the other day on a local repeater. We actually sent something that was 635 words per minute. PSK 125, very narrow mode, but it blasted like crazy. If we wanted it wider, we could have done 5,000 words a minute, something like that. Yeah. It's just people experimenting with radio today. It's not dead. Yeah, maybe old analog radios that look like this you probably have in your basement. I know I do. Yeah, the wife's looking at me. Gotta get rid of that.
You might
need
it one day.
Yeah, hey, you never know, right? I didn't pay him to say that. The thing is, analog radios are made up of so many subcomponents and circuits. Here's a block diagram of what a conventional analog radio looks like. A lot of different parts. However, if you go to pure digital with the software-defined radios, everything's in software except the antenna. Okay? You grab the antenna, you pull in all this energy that's being transmitted, and you present it to the computer that says, oh, I know what to do with this. And it does it. That's what that little thumb drive size SDR radio that Dan was talking about does. Little antenna at one side, grabs it, converts it into digital, and shoves it into the computer and let the software handle it. And it's easy to change. I mean, used to have to write software for specific boards, and then they start consolidating into common software languages, and we're going to get to the point where the stupid thing is going to think for itself. Can anybody say Skynet? Yeah. So, the SDR radio says to the operator, well, I've been in AM radio all my life. I want to become an FM radio now. Operator says, well, you're going to have to reconfigure your demodulator. Well, how do I do that? Well, you need this, you need that. Okay. And it does it. You just give it the instructions, it does it. It's software. You want to create a new mode? Do it. Write the software for it. Tell the thing how to do it. But it's still radio. It's still the voices, the picture, the data that comes over that magical airwaves that scientists 200 years ago, all they knew how to do was to twitch a frog's leg. And look what we're doing today. Questions? Yeah.
I think, how is ontology used in radio? I think in philosophy it's an argument for, an a priori argument for the existence of God or something.
Well, in software it's getting...
logical language.
Right, it's getting it to think about what are the different components of it, what does it need to do? So it's getting it to think a little bit more logically. Yeah, if you could raise the lights. Thanks, Rich. So questioning your own existence is one thing. Now to get the software to say, how do I handle this? Let me logically figure it out. How does it work with other things? So now it becomes smarter.
Also, I think just like a clerk in a store in England is pronounced a clerk, it's James Clerk Maxwell.
James Clerk Maxwell, yeah, yes.
But this was just a fantastic throwback to the little I learned in 1960 physics about radio and the history of sciences.
Mm-hmm.
Just an
invite. Sure. Yes? Yeah. The person who created the Japanese company SoftBank, what was it, Masayoshi's son is his name? There was an article in Slashdot this week where he made a statement saying within 3 decades, artificial intelligence will be smarter than humans and we will have more robots than there are humans on the planet. So again, I say, can somebody say Skynet? For those who don't understand the reference, the Terminator movies. So, yeah, we're at this point that philosophically, we as humans have to decide, are we going to get the software to do this, and where do we control it? But when it comes to what we as hobbyists want to do, we're trying to find more and more tools to let us enjoy our hobby more, to discover the signals, to be actually able to transmit and receive, if you have a license. Transmit and actually interface with others better.
So we're the ones that actually...
We control it.
We control that genie.
We have to be the controllers. And for me, I don't care what the technology is. If it helps me do what I want to do, and I can control it, 2 thumbs up.
So, I don't know if you told the gang, but you are going to continue into the 20th century or thereabouts or whatnot, something like that, on tomorrow afternoon, right?
We could have a discussion session if you want tomorrow afternoon at 4:30. We can continue with some of this.
Yeah.
If that's good for you guys,
We're here. Essentially, Mark Phillips is not going to be able to join us, and so Charles has volunteered to continue the chat in this time slot.
Like I said, especially for the newbies, you know, the ones who really want to understand how does this all work, how do I get started, why this, why that. Those would be great things to talk about tomorrow.
And the review of basics is good.
Review of basics, right, because that's how you build your knowledge.
Yeah.
There you go.
Okay.